Welcome to our paranormal afterlife. This is our paranormal afterlife, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. And if you want to hear the extended version of this episode, please join the Patreon campaign. This week, I'm talking to Irene Blinston about her book, Gazing into the Afterlife, unlocking the mystery of the psychomantium for healing grief in all its forms. Irene is an independent researcher who studies the impact and after effects of supernatural and paranormal experiences, with special interest in encounter experiences. She earned a PhD in transpersonal psychology with specializations in spiritual guidance, creative expression, and transpersonal education and research. Hi, Irene. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So we're going to be talking about your book. It's called Gazing into the Afterlife, Unlocking the Mystery of the Psychomantium for Healing Grief in All Its Forms. First of all, I got to ask, what is a psychomantium?
The psychomantium was developed by Dr. Raymond Moody. He is the one who started the whole near-death experience, NDE. And not only was he a psychiatrist, but he is also has a PhD in Greek philosophy. And he loved the Greeks. He loved Greek philosophy. And he discovered in his readings and during his schooling about a necromantium is where they took people underground in order to contact the dead, basically. And so he was really enamored with that. And he thought, wow, I wonder if we can modify this for something that we could use today. And so he developed what he named the psychomantium. And it's basically it can be any dark room. I have a tent-like structure, and that's what we used in our research. And it is basically sensory deprivation. So we keep it very quiet and it's dark, but they can dim a light so that it's just barely light in there. And we let them sit there in a psychomantium where they look into a mirror, a slanted mirror, where they're not seeing their own reflection. To me, that's a portal into the other side. And so that's where they make contact with their lost loved ones or whoever they want to contact that's passed on, actually.
Yeah. So you were part of this research with Dr. Arthur Hastings.
That's
correct. So can you tell us what you were doing there?
What we wanted to do is we wanted to test Dr. Moody's psychomantium to see if making contact with the dead would actually reduce the symptoms of grief. So what we did as researchers is we facilitated the process and we followed a sequence, a three-part process. I've actually adapted that a little bit more after I graduated, but what we did is we prepped them to go into the psychomantium to contact the person that they wanted to contact. And then once they're in there, we had them stay in there for about 45 minutes to an hour. Then after that, we would debrief them, talking about what was their experience. And I've seen people just come out and feel a sense of peace. I also was witness to, I was honored to take a person through with complicated grief, really, really bad. And she came out completely transformed. I mean, 180. It touched me. It actually affected me to witness her change. And so that's what we were studying. So what we discovered, because we were using assessments before they went in, to find out the level of grief, different symptoms of grief. And then we tested them once they got out. And then we tested them again a month or 2 months later. And what we found is 92% of the people we measured 100 people. And of those 100, 92% had reduced symptoms of grief that lasted over time. So it was phenomenal, one session. And in my book, I interviewed one of my co-researchers, and she was also a facilitator. And she was saying how she was a therapist, and she was saying it was years, sometimes years of therapy in one session, was how it healed grief. It's amazing, actually.
And have you gone through the process? You sat in the psychomantium?
I have been through the psychomantium at least twice, I think. We had to go through it when we were studying. It's like you can't do it unless you've been through it. So I did go through it. And I'm in my experience, my first experience was on Halloween night that we didn't know what we were doing. A guy volunteered to sit with me, and it was before we started the research. So we didn't know what we were doing. But when I was facilitated through after we learned what we were doing, I wanted to contact my father. And this is actually a pretty poignant story because I always wanted my father's approval. Even into adulthood and well into adulthood, getting a PhD, and I still was like trying to get my father's approval. So I was trying to contact him, and I was sitting in the psychomantium on the edge of my seat, like, Dad, come on. And and I said, I just want you to be proud of me. You know, it's like, this is what I've accomplished. Look what I've done. And he hated it anyway, but I was still trying to get his approval. And when I said, I just want you to be proud of me, while I'm sitting on the edge of this chair, it was a cushioned chair that was in there. And I felt like two hands had put on my shoulder and pushed me back into the chair. And a voice came, and I don't know if it was in my head or if it was outside of me, but a voice distinctly said, be proud of yourself. And everything changed. It was like my chest broke open, no pain though, but there was no breaking open. It just was kind of this vision of what was happening to me. And this pink light was shooting out of my chest. And all of a sudden, it was just, I felt this unconditional love. And at the time when I was afterwards, when I was trying to talk about it, I thought it sounds so cheesy, but it was so true. And when I walked out of there, I was actually unable to speak. And so the person who was facilitating me sat with me and asked me questions, and I could kind of just nod my head. And it was the feeling, it's hard to explain, it's ineffable. And it took probably 15 minutes for me to get back down to earth. But what I felt was, it was gone. That feeling for my father's approval was completely 100% gone. And I lived with it my whole life, and it was gone. And you know what, Simon, it still is. It changed my life in that one session in the psychomantium.
Do you feel like you want to do it again?
You know, I'm one of these crazy researchers. So it's like, before we put it to the public, I'll do the risk and go in there. I would have to have the right facilitator to go through it again. Facilitation is vitally important, and they have to be trained correctly. And I say that because I'm the trainer, right? But I was training the facilitators. But I'd go through it again. The thing is, though, it's like, you know, wanting to contact, I don't have a bunch of grief. So, and there's really no one I want to contact, even if I wanted to contact their consciousness. You know, so you can contact consciousness. And so experiments haven't been done on this yet, but I feel like you can contact somebody who's alive. Because consciousness exists, and so you can contact their consciousness. Long story short is I don't have that feeling I need to contact anyone, so that's why I haven't done it again. But if that came up, oh yeah, I definitely want to go through again.
So you say maybe contact people alive.
Yeah.
But would that include people who are in coma or who had Alzheimer's?
Yes. Yeah, I have that in my book as well. Yes. Now, when we were starting the research unit, once we did because I was in it for 3 years and then I graduated and then I was snuck back in, actually. I wasn't supposed to be part of it, but I was kind of snuck back in. So I spent 4 years in the research. And so after we got our 100 people, we did more than 100, but we pulled 100 people that we were going to assess. And once we did that, we started to brainstorm different ways that the psychomantium could be used. And one of the suggestions was from a cohort mate, and she said that she wondered if we could contact people in comas or people with dementia or had Alzheimer's. And I'm thinking, why not? You know, unfortunately, we didn't get to try that. But I can't help but think, why not? You know, why not? It's worth trying.
Yeah, it's a thing where people who have near-death experiences in comas, so it seems like, you know, their consciousness leaves their body while they're in a coma. And there's people who have very disturbing dreams in comas that they say are very realistic.
Right.
So it'd be interesting to see. And also with dementia or Alzheimer's, when it gets to that stage where the person's not communicative, and seeing if we could communicate with their consciousness.
Exactly. Exactly. But keep in mind too, Simon, that when a person dies, their consciousness leaves the body. So even if consciousness is kind of separating itself from the body to a degree, whether it be a near-death experience, whether it be dementia, or whether it be Alzheimer's or coma, then we're looking at the same thing, essentially, is being able to contact that consciousness, not the person. Because people who have dementia and Alzheimer's, that's a brain thing. It's not a mind thing. It's not consciousness that's affected by it, at least from my perspective.
Have you heard of terminal lucidity?
You know, I have heard it, but I don't know about it.
It's when people who may have Alzheimer's and they're getting very close to death and they haven't talked to anybody, they don't recognize anybody, and suddenly they come back and they're like back to normal.
Yes, 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 yes. Now I do know what you're talking about. Yeah, yeah.
It seems the consciousness is still there. It's just the brain's not receiving it properly or processing it properly.
Right. Yeah. And so we still don't have all the answers. So we continue to do research, and these are research studies that are basically self-funded because, there are some funding agencies out there or organizations, but there are so few compared to those who are in hard science. So that's why we don't know as much as we could know if we had the same kind of funding. Like my research, I paid for myself, and this is, I did my own doctoral dissertation research separate from the psychomantium research. But that's one of the issues, is being able to afford to do the research. So we're, that's a downside of this type of work.
I can imagine presenting this to possible, like, people who are going to give you a grant or something and describing the psychomantium to them. They'd be like, are you crazy?
Right. they still do. It's like there's a lot of people don't even want to talk about it. That's one of the things that I enjoy about Raymond Moody, is that, he really kind of revels in talking about it and doing speaking engagements and things like that. Although he doesn't focus as much on the psychomantium anymore. But that's just his personality. But that is something that I wasn't clinical. I didn't go into the clinical program. Although I took all the clinical classes, I didn't continue on with that. It's not my thing. I want to be a researcher. So that's something that when you get into the clinical side of it, then it becomes problematic because even the American Psychological Association and American Psychiatric Association, it's not even they poo-poo it. They just completely don't even go there. So it's it's really difficult to be accepted on that side of the world. and I didn't care, you know, where a lot of clinical people, they have to care if they want to be taken seriously and their licensing and things like that.
Can anybody be a participant in a psychomantium, or is it you have to have, like, there is there anything that's contraindicated?
Yes, absolutely. Because we're looking at a altered state of consciousness that takes place when a person is in a sensory deprived state, that it can cause problems. So anyone who has had a psychotic episode or has been diagnosed with a psychotic disorder, anyone who is on antipsychotic medications, this is the kind of thing that could trigger an episode. So we definitely have to be really, really stringent about making sure that we get people in who are, I don't want to sound like I'm being really negative about people who have mental illness, but it's mental illness can be triggered. There are lots of things that can trigger it, not just going into a psychomantium, but you have to be really hypervigilant about it. And we, in any kind of research too, Simon, not just in psychomantium research, we have to really care about the person. We want them to be safe. And that is a real big priority. And safety first, do no harm. So we do have assessments and things that we do to make sure that a person is won't suffer from going through it. And we do the best we can. But for the most part, the screening, you have to do really stringent screening to make sure that someone like that is not put through that, because it could be detrimental.
And you were looking into this for the healing of grief.
Right.
And so were there people grieving that were unsuitable because perhaps they were just too emotional?
No. Actually, that's the thing. It's everybody gets emotional, because when we prep them for the prep them before they could go into the psychomantium, we actually have them bring mementos or pictures and things like that, so they can be really focused on the person that they want to contact. And it's not uncommon. Y'all always have to have tissues ready, because it does bring up the emotional feelings for people when they are remembering their lost loved one. But that's you know, you expect that. And some people, they're not really suffering from huge grief symptoms, but they really feel like they had unfinished business. And so some may cry, some may not. They just want to be able to get into the psychomantium so they can communicate. And I kind of push the communication part of it. This is one of the things that was problematic with people who read Dr. Raymond Moody's book, Reunions, because his focus was not just primarily, but solely on apparitions, where the person who's going through psychomantium is actually going to see the person who passed on. That's so rare to have that happen. So I always indicated that the mirror, which is at an angle, so they can't see themselves, but they look into the mirror, and the mirror is the portal. It's like ET phone home. You know, it's like talking to the mirror, because that's where the veil is. And we open up that veil through the mirror, and they can speak to the person who has passed on. So, and there's a variety of experiences that happen to people in there, but that's my primary thing, because most of the time people, they have things that were unsaid, you know, and so they want to be able to talk to the person who passed on. So that's a primary focus when I was facilitating, but also to be open to anything, you know, to be aware of your surroundings and anything that might be happening during the time that they're in there.
So in your study of the 100 participants, did mm-hmm. any of them see apparitions?
Yes, actually. Of the 100 participants, I know at least one did. Also, when we were training, the facilitators training, one of the people in our cohort, the research unit, he saw his mother. So there, that was a full apparition. And interesting too, this is something that you read about, is people seeing a person who's passed on and they look younger and healthier. And that is what he described, how he saw his mother. But there's also a person, I know of at least one, who saw, and I can't remember off the top of my head if it was a father or mother, but it was an apparition of a relative that they went into contact. It's rare though, Simon. It's rare to see an apparition, so I'm always trying to downplay it.
I suppose that's part of the pre-session briefing.
Well, the pre-session briefing, I usually do that part about expectations when I'm just about to take them to go into the psychomantium. And while they sit in the psychomantium, I remind them about the mirror and communication through the mirror and things like that. So, yeah, but the primary purpose of the pre-session is to prep them and to get them really thinking and being. So their mind is focused mainly on the person that they want to contact.
So when somebody's sitting there, is it possible to have somebody with them, or do you have to be completely out of the room?
I always offer, if someone feels like they're a little bit nervous, and they'll tell you, I'll tell them that I'll sit in the psychomantium with them. I'll sit up right outside. It's a tent-like structure, so right outside the flap where it opens, I'll sit right outside there. So whatever makes them feel comfortable, I'm happy to do that. And I haven't had to do it once. People are going, oh, good, because I want you with me. And by the time I get them to the psychomantium, they don't even want me outside the tent. They want me in another room. So they want to be in there by themselves. And that has to do with good being a good facilitator and the sense of making them feel as comfortable as possible.
Now, can you tell us about Carol's psychomantium experience? This is in the book. And I think is it an amalgamation of several people?
Yeah, it is an amalgamation of several people. This would be a transformation of complicated grief, more than likely. And complicated grief is when a person is not getting over the grief. They're, in fact, the grief doesn't change. There's no shift. And after 6 months, a year, 18 months, their life is being ruined. Their work is being ruined. Everything around them is being destroyed because they can't function. And so I may have had her be a complicated grief person, but this is where a person whose child gets hit by a car and killed, and then taking them through the psychomantium, and they come out transformed. And so whether they see their child or, and this was, part of that is based on a true story of the person that I took through, and that she was transformed because her daughter spoke to her. This is a person where she heard the voice, and her daughter told her that her mother was suffering and a great deal of pain, thinking that that's how they were going to stay connected. And so the daughter told her mother that we don't need to be connected by pain because we're always connected by love. I get emotional when I talk about this one because that's the one I took through. And when she came out, I was so touched. It was hard not to cry. Her transformation was so amazing. But that the Carol story was very much based on that and other people who have lost children.
Because you have a side table in there, don't you, with tissues on it? So there must be people crying often.
Yes, yes. Always have to have tissues. We also have tissues in the psychomantium. That's something that, you know, you have to have up there because these are emotional things. And even when this woman who went through the major transformation, just before it was her time to come out of the psychomantium, I heard her just scream out. And I'm in a separate room, but I could hear her because there's a wall where the psychomantium was. And I thought, oh gosh. And I thought, okay, we've got about 5 more minutes. And she was crying and sobbing in there. And why she was doing that was because she was so happy that her daughter had talked to her. and that, and she got it. She told me, she goes, I got it. She goes, we're connected by love. I don't have to hurt like this. She's always there. And it was, I mean, it, I needed the tissues on that one.
It's like a lot of sort of things where you people go and see mediums or lots of different sort of experiences people have. It's different. Everybody's different and everybody processes it differently. Right. And I suppose with the psychomantium, there's no guaranteed results. It's not like everybody's going to have that sort of experience.
No, not at all. That's a rarity with that type of transformation. I don't want to call it rare, but in our case, that's the only one that I did that was that dramatic. Transformation and transformation of the grief, it does happen, but that was really dramatic as well. So it does happen. Now, there are cases where even when they feel like they didn't get the experience that they wanted, I would say the majority of people that I took through, and I took about almost 40 people through, I think. So not quite half, a little over a third of those 100 I took through. And of those, if they came out and it's like they didn't get the experience they want, and typically that was I didn't get to see the person, they wanted the apparition, they still had reduced symptoms and they had a sense of peace. And that kind of blew me away, you know. It was just like, I'm disappointed, but I feel peaceful about it. It was amazing, actually.
What about the person's frame of mind while they're doing this? I suppose they have to be positive and believe that something could happen. It's no good putting a skeptic in there.
Well, I think you could put a skeptic in there, but they're going to get out of it what they put in it, I suppose. I think that a person cannot help what happens in a sensory deprived environment. So because it's low light, no sound, we try to keep no sense of smell. There's no smell in it. You know, we try to deprive all the senses. So it does create a light altered state, sometimes a heavier altered state of consciousness. And something will typically happen in this, like they're going to see something. What you see a lot of times is your eyes are trying to adjust to the darkness and your brain is trying to adjust to being sensory deprived. And so there's sometimes people will see colors or like little lightning bolts of green or purple or, you know, red, different colors. They're going to see something in there because their eyes and brain are trying to adjust to it. So they will come out of the psychomantium typically saying nothing happened. And that's when you have to do the post session because you get to talk to them about their experience and then they begin to remember. If you take them step by step through the process and then they typically start to remember. And usually when that happens, they become amazed themselves of all the things that did happen while they were in there. And I don't remember taking a skeptic through, but I did take someone through. He was from China, and so he really had no religion, and he wanted to contact his wife. And I think he read Reunions, Dr. Moody's book. And so I always tell him, don't be thinking you're going to get an apparition, just accept whatever comes through. But when he finally came out, he was resigned. I mean, it's like he said, I knew I had expectations. He goes, but I'm glad I did this. He goes, I'm really glad I did this because I feel a lot better. Why he felt better, I have no idea, but he did. And that's that sense of peace that happens. I have no explanation for it, to be honest with you.
Hi, this is Simon. Do you have a fascination with reincarnation? And would you like to know about your past lives? I have a diploma in clinical hypnotherapy and I conduct past life regression sessions over Zoom. If you'd like to find out how a session works for you, you can book a free 20-minute consultation on my website. That's at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. The link is in the show notes. And were there cases where perhaps they experienced nothing in the psychomantium, but they did when they got home over the next few days?
Yeah, I always tell them to expect, not to expect it to be, but to be aware. Yeah. I've gotten calls from people that I've taken through that said nothing happened, and they remember, you know, like they saw colors or whatever, but to them that was a disappointment, or it was typically, I've had a person, at least one, leave that I had the sense that that person was disappointed. But I got a call like 2 weeks later, and you know, she was changed. She just goes, I wanted to let you know that I saw this, or I, you know, whatever it might have been, that I had this sign, and now I get it. I understand. Thank you so much. And then they're so grateful. So it can happen later. The psychomantium may be initiating a process, and that it gets completed once the person is home, and it could be even 2 weeks later in the case of this one person. Yeah, that can happen, definitely. And in fact, somebody had walked outside after the whole process was completed and filled out the questionnaire and wrote everything down and walked outside to the person's car. And then that's saw some sign and let us know about that. And that she was, you know, she's like, I get it. Oh my gosh, this happened. And the excitement is pretty cool when they do that, because then it makes us feel a little bit better if they're leaving disappointed. And then they recognize that actually something did happen and they had a sign and they recognize what they forgot about in the psychomantium, or even something that is just letting them know afterwards, like the woman who had it. Was disappointed and then 2 weeks later called me. So yeah, I have no explanation to why there is a length of time afterwards or what's happened to them to cause the transformation. But there's a part of me that really believes pretty heavily that the psychomantium experience initiated it.
Yeah, well, that would seem to be the thing, wouldn't it? If they're not experiencing it at all before that.
Right.
So was there a man who had quite an amazing experience, but he wanted to see his father and his father didn't show up, so he was quite disappointed, but it sounded amazing.
Yeah, I think you're talking about, again, I facilitated this person through, if it's who I'm thinking of, that his father was a professional musician and composer, and he played the piano. That one was amazing. That particular person wanted to contact his father who had died. And when we were prepping for him to go into the psychomantium, he was telling me about his father and how his father was a musician. He was a pianist, and that he was, you know, he actually was a professional musician from what I remember. And that he really wanted to contact his father. He wanted to see his father. And this was a case of, I read reunions and I want to see my father. And so I was just like, those ones were always tough for me, because I thought, oh God, their expectation, it makes it rough. So he went into the psychomantium in his allotted time. And when I went to open the flap to let him out, he's just like, nothing happened. And he goes, but I'm really upset and I'll tell you about it. And so we went into the session room where we pre and post session. And I asked him, okay, what's going on? He said, well, I'm really disappointed because it was really hard to focus. And I'm like, why? And he said, because someone turned on, like someone was playing music. Someone had right on the other side of the wall, I think, there's like a CD player or something, and they were playing music. He goes, I recognized it because it's what my father used to play. And I said, really? And he goes, and it was loud and it was very disturbing. He goes, I'm so disappointed. You guys really have to pay attention to what's going on here, because that's disruptive. And I was just looking at him, really? And I said, there was no music playing. There are no CD players. There's nothing in here because we have to keep it quiet. And he just looked at me, and I just let him process that. And really, he really didn't say a whole lot after that. He just, you know, he recognized that something did happen. He didn't see his father, but he did get some kind of message because he heard his father playing music. And that one was pretty mind-blowing because he was so adamant that it just messed up his whole session because they were playing music and disrupting his experience. But he goes, I recognize it's because a piece my father used to play. Yeah, so that's when he got it. It was like, oh, I see.
Do you think if you had been in the psychomantium or just standing outside it, you would have heard that as well? Or do you think it was just him?
I wonder about that. Just with my own experience too, when it said, be proud of yourself, I don't know if that was coming outside of me or that it was inside of me. And so I really don't know. We've talked about doing group sessions. Here's the problem with that, Simon, is that everybody has different ideas. And even though we say we're all going to focus on the same thing, everybody is going to have a little twist on that. And what you're doing is just creating static, in my view. So even when I said I would sit in the psychomantium with someone, I was hoping that they wouldn't ask me to, because I would just have to keep I'd have to empty my mind as much as I could. I'm not that good of a meditator, but I would do the best I could. But that was my concern. No one else seemed to be concerned about it, but it was certainly my concern, because then you may have conflicting messages to the universe or whatever, you know, the ether. And I really wanted to avoid that. So I don't know. I've been asked that before. In fact, you just reminded me of something, and this is not in my book, I don't think. Somebody who was in a previous research group, anyway, he went in and he took a recorder with him. And he wanted to record his session and to make sure if there's any noise or any sounds or any voices or whatever. So he recorded the session. And if I remember correctly, he had found the recording, and when he found it, there was nothing but like static on it. So there was something, but it was staticky on the recording.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you've ever thought of sound or video recording.
Actually, yeah, we did. This is the thing, and bless you, Dr. Hastings up in heaven. We had all kinds of equipment. We had infrared camera. We had it, you know, like I can't think of the name of it. You just got to brain stop there, but the measuring devices for the brain and brainwave stuff and things like that. But we never used it. And that was disappointing because we had all the equipment there. But I think Dr. Hastings' reasons was that for this particular research, he didn't want to disrupt the process for the person. That's my guess. So that he may have thought once we have this part of the research completed, then perhaps we would probably on ourselves and maybe some volunteers, but primarily it probably would have been done to us as part of the research unit, that we would be the ones going through all hooked up and have the cameras running and things like that. But yeah, we did have the stuff, but we didn't use it.
I suppose having all that hooked up and having cameras on you could just ruin the whole thing of emptying your mind and getting into it.
I think so, personally. That's why I thought if we're going to do it, let's do it on us. You know, I'll go. But it would be disruptive for, you know, and make somebody uncomfortable. And also there's all kinds of things that happen in research with participants, because there are those that don't want to do it wrong. And there are those that want to please the researcher. And so you're not going to get true readings, you know, as far as they may be manipulating it, not like because they're trying to be malicious, but they're trying to help, you know. So it wouldn't have worked out probably either way with using regular people to come in. I think it would have had to been all of us who were part of the research unit to do that. But we didn't. So I was just like, oh, I really wanted to. But by the time, you know, we were able to really do something like that, I graduated and I was gone, but and really doing my own psychomantium thing. But the others might have done that. I really don't know. I asked one person about it, but they didn't know if it was being done or not. But I do know one of my cohort mates, he set it up for himself. But it was, you know, it didn't work out. He was by himself. He didn't have a facilitator. It was, you know, you have to have a facilitator with you because you lose track of time. And if you're trying to pay attention to everything else, you know, is the camera running? It was like you're not focusing on what you're in the psychomantium to do. So
when you're doing the pre-session and you're briefing them, do you behave as if this is genuine contact with the dead and you believe in the afterlife? It's almost like it's the power of suggestion or something. Because if you're negative about that, that might affect their frame of mind.
It could. I think to go through this, you have to have kind of a sense of woo-woo. I do believe that all of us as facilitators would have to have some belief in the survival of consciousness after death and that it's something that can be contacted. But, I mean, we have to look at also that people go to psychomantiums. All right, Irene. People go to mediums, you know, and because they want to make contact. And so I think also, too, we have to look at the school that I went to, Simon. I went to the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology. Unfortunately, it doesn't exist anymore. But so my PhD is in transpersonal psychology. So anybody who's going to that school has that kind of mindset that it's beyond the personal, it's in transpersonal, it's spiritual. I mean, things we studied were like psi, you know, parapsychology, the paranormal, supernatural, amongst with altered states of consciousness. You know, and we had some doing, you know, entheogen studies, which is, you know, like ayahuasca and, you know, cactus, peyote and things like that, that are mind-altering substances. So that's the kind of mindset that people would have that came into our school. So I would say that everybody that went through it had some inkling of belief that consciousness does survive and consciousness is out there and that you can make contact so that there is some kind of afterlife or there is some kind of life after death, you know? And so that's how we went into it. That was my belief. I mean, I think a lot of people, Pew Research did a study and they actually, when I was in school, they did it and it still didn't change much as far as the belief in paranormal stuff, like people believing in ghosts or believing in the afterlife. It's in the Pew Research, they did, I can't remember the date, but I think it was 2023, may have been 2024, but they had 73% of their respondents said they believed in ghosts, they believed in the paranormal. So, but they don't talk about it, Simon. I mean, you can imagine, right? It's like 73, that's like almost 3/4 of the population believes in it, but we can't talk about it because it's taboo or, you know, they're going to think I'm crazy or whatever. This is one of my biggest, one of the things that makes me nuts because there's so much to the human potential and researchers are too afraid to study it. Because hard science is saying, if it can't be measured, it doesn't exist. And so it's, you know, I'm sorry, I'm getting on my getting on my soapbox here. But that's one of the things that there's so much we don't know. There is so much we don't know. As humans, our potential, I mean, in my mind, it must be phenomenal. But we don't know it yet. So just using the psychomantium is just, you know, a touching on that of our potential to make contact or be in contact with those who passed on with their consciousness or whatever happens when you pass on. So I'll try to get off my soapbox, but it'll be hard.
It says in the book, you created an extensive facilitator certification program.
Yes, I have.
Is it a thing where maybe you could Google it and perhaps find a facilitator in your city?
Not yet. right now, this is the sad situation because I don't think Dr. Moody is doing it anymore. I was in a fire, burned down. My house burned down and my psychomantium burned down with it. So I haven't had my psychomantium replaced. So I don't do sessions right now. I refer to a person in Oklahoma who was trained under Dr. Moody. To my knowledge, of anyone that I would refer to, she's the only one in the United States and maybe the world that is actually doing psychomantium sessions. So there is a need for sure. And so I will be having a psychomantium built so that I will be available. But I want to train facilitators because if 73% of the population believes in this type of thing, and also 30% of adults in the United States see a medium at least once a year. 30%. So if we have a bunch of grieving people that believe in the paranormal, we're depriving them of this opportunity. I mean, granted, I do it in a 2-hour session. In our research, we did it in 3. So I want to train facilitators, but it's a process, you know, there's a lot of training that goes with it. It's going to require that they have supervised practice. And then when they're on their own, they still need supervision. So it's a year long program that I put together. And that will be offered. I have put it out there very little, but my book is now out. So I want to get that awareness out there more for this particular training. It's a certification program because then I can refer them, you know, and like I'm doing a podcast right now with you. I'll continue to do podcasts. Well, one, I love talking about the topic, but also let people know that this is available. And my website is being built up right now. And then I will have a page where it will have the certified facilitators and what part of the world or in part of the country here in the United States anyway, but probably the world where somebody could reach out and find a facilitator that is somewhat close to them. I mean, I've had people in England want to fly to California to go through the psychomantium. So it's something that is desired and it's just not available.
Do you know if any of the participants was a medium or had mediumship kind of talents?
That's a really good question. I don't know. I didn't ask them if they were a medium. But as far as mediumship, that I don't know. As far as psychic abilities, if you believe in that kind of thing, which I do, obviously. Yeah, a lot of people went through that were probably a little more psychically inclined. Now, one of the things, too, that we discovered was that the persons that were going to have probably the most experiences, I don't even want to say it that way, but if you in the Myers-Briggs, it's, you know, people go, I'm an INFP or whatever, those acronyms, the ones who are intuitive and feeling, they have probably more, I would say they have more experiences in the psychomantium than the thinking and sensing function types.
Do you have another session that stands out for you that you could tell us about?
Well, it's, I took so many people through and it was a long time ago, but I just remember that in a difficult case, everybody pointed at me. Is who's going to facilitate this person through? It was me. I took some really tough cases through, like a sister of somebody who was murdered, suicides. And I didn't take anyone through whose child was the person who killed somebody, but I have with the person whose child was killed. And so I did do all of those tough cases. And that's where the peace comes from. Because I mean, that's, they wanted to know why. That was typically, it's like, why did they do it? You know, why did my son commit suicide? And why did my brother commit suicide? And so they wanted to go in to find out why, what happened. And I remember one particular case. I think I wrote about this in my book, but I can't remember. There was one case where there was jealousy. And I think that was actually, it was in this case, it was one child killed the other. And there was jealousy involved, that they felt that they were neglected. And the mother was the one who went into the psychomantium. And if memory serves me right, when she came out, that she was saying that the person felt neglected and was jealous, and felt like that they were unloved. And so she was able to process that in the post session with me, and understood that she didn't see that happening, and that it was her lack of awareness in her mind, that it was her lack of awareness of that. And, you know, and in the session afterwards, I'm able to talk to her and have her talk, you know, talk through it. And when, by the time that she left that session, she felt a sense of peace about it, because then she knew what happened. That's how she felt. So that's one particular case that was pretty dramatic. And then a sister wanted to know why her brother committed suicide. And what was interesting in her case is that she didn't get the answer from her brother, but it was an opportunity to talk, you know, to speak. And it may be that there was some kind of unspoken telepathic communication, but she came out with a feeling like she had some sense of understanding, and that she was at that point feeling at peace with it, and that she didn't need to go. It's like, you know, can we go back in again? You know, people will say, can we do this again? But when they come out, then they're just like, I feel at peace with this. Like, they don't need to do it again. So that was one of the things that really touched me, is that they thought, if I don't get what I want, can I go back in? And some people are looking at it like, oh, this is going to be fun. You know, this is, it's like playing the Ouija board or something. Mm-hmm. But it's not as very serious. And so having them come out with a sense of peace or understanding actually made me, it's like I said, as a facilitator, we need supervision. We need debriefing, because we actually are witness to, if you're slightly bit sensitive, which I am very sensitive, you're witness to this change in a person. And some people say it's an honor, which it is, but it's also like, oh my gosh, you're part of that transformation in some way. It's hard to describe, but it's really like, I need to talk to somebody after this. Me, I can't. So that's the kind of, it can be really, really powerful.
You say in the book that you developed and refined the modern psychomantium protocol. So right. What was involved in that? What did you need to refine and develop?
Well, it didn't need to take as long as it did. In our research, we did 1 hour to prep them for the psychomantium, 1 hour in the psychomantium, and 1 hour post-session where we the debrief after. When I graduated, I was doing 45 minutes. And it was, you know, it's just interesting. It's kind of like, just let the universe know this is divine time. And now it's like 40 minutes. So it doesn't have to be a 3-hour process. It can be a 2-hour process, because transformation happens. Also, I'm a lot more diligent about certain things. And this is, because Dr. Moody didn't train us. Dr. Hastings, the director of the research unit, he was somewhat using Dr. Moody's process, but Dr. Moody spent a whole day with people sometimes, and he had a room for his, you know, prep to put them into the psychomantium was to start the altered state of consciousness, and we didn't have that. And as much as I love Raymond Diamond, I don't think it's necessary. So I just looked at it as like we have this 40 minutes to prep, 40 minutes in and 40 minutes after. I also am really diligent about the care of the psychomantium itself. As much as I love Dr. Hastings, he didn't think about the mirror is the portal. And I was just like, we got to cover the mirror. You know, whenever a mirror is used for this purpose, it can't be used for anything else, in my view. That mirror has become the portal, and it needs to be covered until, and if it's the cover is lifted, it's used for communication purposes or connection. And he just didn't, you know, he didn't believe in that. He didn't feel that was necessary. And so here we have, you know, in my view, we've got like spirits, you know, all over the counseling center where we were working. You know, they're just like popping out of the mirror going free for all. And, you know, I wanted to avoid that. I wasn't the only one either. In fact, a person who I have in my book, Dr. Rebecca Murs, she and I, in fact, she saw someone coming, a ghost or whatever you want to call it, a spirit, coming through the wall out of the psychomantium room. And I'm just like, we've got to cover that mirror. But that's one of the things. Another is that after each session, the psychomantium needs to be cleared. Because we're not going to be burning sage or anything like that, because it leaves a scent, you know, so we have to make sure that there's no scent in there. So there's different things that can be used, like crystals, but then those crystals have to be switched out each session and cleansed. But that's part of my protocol, because I feel it's vitally important that each person go into a completely clean, spiritually clean psychomantium, that each person who leaves, the mirror gets covered. And when the new person comes in after the room has been cleaned, then the cover comes off the mirror. So it's a new session. So that's part of the psychomantium protocol that I use. And also I'm probably a little more strict about pre-qualifying people, you know, making sure that they are truly eligible to go through the psychomantium, meaning that, you know, they're not like a highly depressed person I wouldn't want to put through them. So I have to be more strict about that. And it might be too, because, you know, I mean, I'm not, when I was in school as a student, and same with Dr. Hastings, because we were under the auspices of the school and that insurance and things like that. But I, you know, for me as especially training people who are going to be doing this as their business, or at least part of their business, but it could be their whole business. I want them to really understand the need for safety first, and to really be hyper conscious about who can go through and who cannot. So that is how I'm just strict and probably more hardcore about protecting people.
Well, it's been great talking to you. The book's called Gazing into the Afterlife, Unlocking the Mystery of the Psychomantium for Healing Grief in All Its Forms. The book's on Amazon, isn't it?
It is. It actually can be purchased at anywhere in the world where you can buy books. It can, whether it be the ebook form or ordering it from bookstores. I have it so that it's available all around the world. And for your listeners who might be interested in just seeing if it's something that, you know, they would like to buy, I'm offering them to have the up to the first chapter for free. And I will get you a link for that It will be at chapter.portaltohealinggrief.com. So chapter.portaltohealinggrief.com. And I can get that to you too, Simon. So,
yeah, that'd be great. I'll put that link in the show notes.
Okay, awesome. Thank you.
Well, it's been great talking to you. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. I had a lot of fun talking to you. You're awesome. Thank you.
This week, I was talking to Irene Blinston, PhD, about her book, Gazing into the Afterlife, Unlocking the Mystery of the Psychomantium for Healing Grief in All Its Forms. If you want to hear the rest of this interview, you can sign up to Patreon. The Patreon episodes are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/ourparanormalafterlife or click on the Patreon button on my homepage at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. The links are in the show notes. And my book, Verified Near-Death Experiences, is on Amazon and you can get it on paperback, audiobook or Kindle. And if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.